Chapter 5. The Truth About Cholesterol. In this chapter, you will learn, doctors have heard that cholesterol causes heart attacks so often we fail to question the idea. Cholesterol is a nutrient, not a toxin. More research suggests that lowering cholesterol increases the risk of heart attacks than vice versa. The fact that vegetable oil lowers cholesterol may be another sign of its toxicity. People with lower cholesterol are less healthy and more likely to die than people with high cholesterol. If you're like most of my patients, you probably believe you eat a relatively decent diet. But do you? The answer to that question depends on whom you ask. Most of us believe we make the right choices more often than we make bad ones. But in 2022, when a group of dietitians evaluated the eating habits of over 9,000 Americans using their Healthy Eating Index, they gave 70% of them an F. The index awarded points for eating fruits, vegetables, whole grains, and protein, and for avoiding refined grains, sugar, and cholesterol-elevating saturated fat. Nearly two-thirds, 71% of participants had ranked their diets as good, very good, or excellent, while the dietitians ranked only 12% of the participants' diets that highly. Fully 94% of those who scored an F thought they should have at least gotten a D. This exuberant overconfidence reflects an interesting human foible, the tendency of people who are unaware of their deficiencies to simply assume that none exist. But we all face this dilemma. No matter how smart we may be, we simply don't know what we don't know. How could we? Psychologists David Dunning and Justin Kruger have warned that this quirk of human behavior gives experts trained in one field overconfidence in others in which they are not trained, a widely accepted idea which is now called the Dunning-Kruger effect. But their finding implies another possibility that's a bit terrifying. What if the Dunning-Kruger effect applies to an entire field? In other words, what if the dietitians grading the healthfulness of people's diets based on their saturated fat content should have been looking at vegetable oil consumption instead? Dietitians, doctors, and other health authorities could all be completely wrong about the healthfulness of common dietary fats. But if they're not looking for evidence that they might be wrong, they would have no way of discovering the error. If our health authorities believe a toxic ingredient is healthy, then how would we ever learn the truth? Answer: we probably wouldn't, at least not for a long, long time. For a long time, I was one of those doctors. I'd never heard anything negative about vegetable oil during any of my schooling, not in college, not in medical school, and not during specialty training in family medicine. It's a common perception that doctors don't learn about nutrition because the topic of food and healthy eating is a brief moment in our long curriculum. But we do actually learn a great deal about the fundamental processes by which our bodies assimilate and utilize nourishment. My experience was unusual because I graduated from one of the few medical schools that offered a nutrition course. I discovered later that a good part of dietitians' curriculum includes those fundamental processes. So we physicians don't need much more education to be caught up with most of what dietitians learn. The problem is, much of our education on nutrition is wrong. Long before studying nutrition in school, I'd been programmed to accept vegetable oils into my life. It wasn't actually a conscious thought. It was a feeling of trust and safety. And it was so potent that I still remember the moment it was first injected into me. I was probably 8 or 9. I picked up one of my dad's medical journals, lying open to an advertisement for vegetable oils, right at eyeball height on a counter stool in the kitchen. The full-page color picture showed oil that glinted gold like liquid sunlight. and something about the ad copy made me want to run to our refrigerator to check if we had margarine or butter sitting in the door. Margarine. I felt relieved. From that day forward, for the next 3 decades, I never questioned the idea that butter was bad for me, and plant oils were liquid sunlight, somehow capable of ensuring that my blood would keep flowing. I trusted that they were safe. I saw similar ads again and again in Time, Newsweek, and on TV. Years later, in my high school health classes, I learned that saturated fats are unhealthy because they raise cholesterol. But as with my thinking on vegetable oils, this training had also begun well before high school. Ever since I'd learned to read, I'd eaten my breakfast grape nuts staring at the cereal box, reading the back, the front, the side, as if it were the most fascinating stuff. So many cereals I'd grown up eating claimed to be healthy because they lowered cholesterol. I don't remember ever questioning the idea that cholesterol clogged arteries. After all, something has to cause heart attacks, and cholesterol happens to have a clogged up, choking sound right in its name. Cholesterol. I had this image in my mind of cholesterol building up in my arteries like grease building up in a pipe, slowly choking them off. I've since come to understand that the vegetable oil is healthy campaign is inextricably wedded to the cholesterol is bad concept. Once consumers believe cholesterol causes heart attacks, then publicizing the fact that vegetable oils lower cholesterol makes them the antidote to heart attacks, which makes consumers want to buy them. The combination of package marketing, a plausible-sounding scientific explanation, and the dramatic use of clogged pipe imagery convinced millions of families just like mine that cholesterol was a killer and vegetable oil was heart healthy. We avoided saturated fat-rich foods like butter and beef because of cholesterol. We bought skim milk because of cholesterol. And we bought margarine and products containing vegetable oil instead of animal fats because of cholesterol. I've also come to understand that the image of cholesterol clogging arteries is a carefully crafted product of the mid-20th century. The origin of this image is a vitally important piece of American history, and we're going to learn more about it later. The reality is that there is a lot more to the story of what causes heart attacks than that simple picture of grease in a pipe. It's a different story altogether. But before we get there, we need to look at the nutrient that's been framed as a public health enemy, cholesterol. What is cholesterol? The world is seemingly more afraid of cholesterol than of heart attacks. When we cut out seed oils, our cholesterol very often goes up. If we start eating more butter, cheese, and other saturated fat-rich foods, it can go up quite high, since saturated fat raises blood cholesterol levels. This scares most people quite a bit. In my first few years of sharing what I'd learned about vegetable oils with patients, after I'd reassured folks that cholesterol was actually nothing to worry about because it didn't cause heart attacks, I'd often get a puzzling objection. But high cholesterol runs in my family. It flummoxed me, because I initially didn't understand the mistaken belief behind the statement. Eventually, I realized that the concern reflects a common belief that cholesterol is a toxic byproduct that doesn't belong in the bloodstream. So, of course, my reassurances fell on deaf ears. It would be as if I just told them not to worry about cancerous cells in their body. Now I know that to effectively alleviate worry, I have to tell folks the good things they never get to hear about cholesterol, so they can understand why high blood levels might actually be a good thing. Cholesterol is neither a toxin nor a byproduct. It is a nutrient that every cell in your body requires for basic functions. To the naked eye, it appears as a waxy fat-like substance. At the molecular level, it's bulky and flat, and its unique shape and charge properties make it capable of keeping our cell membranes just flexible enough to avoid solidifying, which would be immediately fatal, but not so fluid that we melt, also fatal. The body goes through a great deal of trouble to make cholesterol because it's so essential. Most cells can make their own if they have to. But cholesterol can come from our diet, too, particularly from foods like eggs, butter, liver, and shellfish. Most of the cholesterol in our blood is made in the liver and our intestinal cells. These cells need cholesterol to manufacture little fat delivery vehicles called lipoproteins that they release into the bloodstream. These lipoproteins contain the cholesterol your doctor measures on blood tests. They work like tiny amphibious vehicles that ferry fat and fat-soluble vitamins through your arteries along a delivery route, making stops at cells that need the vitamins, essential fats, and other nutrients they're carrying, including cholesterol. What do they do with the cholesterol? Cholesterol is the body's equivalent of duct tape. It's one of the most versatile nutrients our cells have, and they use it for solving all sorts of problems. And it's more than just a problem solver. It's also a building block. It enables cell division, the rapidly dividing cells in our intestinal tract, skin, and bone marrow need it more than most other kinds of cells in our bodies. It enables cell transport and communication. Cells need cholesterol to create structures called lipid rafts that are essential to responding to hormones and to moving large molecules into the cell, out of the cell, and from place to place within the cell. It's the precursor for vitamin D, which forms when ultraviolet light rays strike cholesterol in the skin. Vitamin D helps our bodies absorb calcium. It provides waterproofing for our skin and other boundary layers within our bodies. It helps our brains and nerve cells conduct electricity. The brain is 15% cholesterol by dry weight, a higher proportion than any other organ in our bodies. It's the precursor to numerous hormones called steroid hormones. These include the well-known sex hormones, testosterone, estrogen, and cortisol, which give us energy. And there are dozens more, including the supplements many people buy for health and performance enhancement, such as DHEA and adrenal extracts. Doctors know all this, but the prevailing wisdom holds that too much of a good thing can be a problem. This too much of a good thing idea makes no sense, however, when you realize that the levels cardiologists now consider safe for people at high risk, 70 milligrams per deciliter or lower, are almost unachievable without drugs. What's more, if cholesterol levels truly needed to be that low for us to be healthy, then healthy people would have lower cholesterol than unhealthy people. But as we're going to explore, it seems that healthier people tend to have higher cholesterol levels. Still, I wouldn't blame you for doubting this contrarian viewpoint. After all, I'm saying that our country's 1,077,115 physicians are getting it wrong. The sad fact is that doctors can't apply what they learn to draw logical conclusions about cholesterol when they are continually bombarded by messaging about how dangerous it is. Let me give you just one example of how healthcare professionals can be misled. Large epidemiological studies and meta-analyses have conclusively confirmed the lack of correlation between dietary cholesterol, the cholesterol you take in when you eat cholesterol-containing foods, typically meat and dairy, and blood cholesterol, the level of cholesterol circulating in your blood. The evidence is abundant enough that the government committee that sets the official U.S. dietary guidelines revised their report in 2015 to state that cholesterol is not a nutrient of concern for overconsumption. In spite of this, standard nutrition advice still warns people away from most foods high in cholesterol. Why? Because standard nutrition advice still holds that high levels of blood cholesterol clog arteries and cause heart attacks, and the word association dietary versus blood cholesterol confuses even professionals. Good cholesterol bad cholesterol. You've probably heard the terms good cholesterol and bad cholesterol. These terms refer to two subtypes of lipoproteins, those tiny amphibious vehicles that carry fats throughout our circulatory system. One subtype, called low-density lipoprotein, LDL, is said to be the bad cholesterol. Another subtype, high-density lipoprotein, HDL, is said to be the good cholesterol. These terms are imprecise at best, since there is only one molecule called cholesterol, and that molecule is the same in all our lipoproteins. Where did they come from? Way back in 1958, a doctor at Cleveland Clinic named Angelo M. Scanu coined the term good cholesterol when he observed that people with high HDL tended to have lower heart attack risk. He hypothesized that HDL might clean up the cholesterol that LDL seemed to deposit in our arteries. At some point, people started calling LDL bad cholesterol based on these ideas. But by the 1990s, accumulating evidence suggested that LDL does not, in fact, deposit cholesterol in our arteries, unless it's oxidized. What's more, we've also discovered that HDL can harm our arteries too when it's oxidized. It seems time to abandon these imprecise, outdated terms and focus on the real bad player, oxidation. So, we've seen that dietary cholesterol isn't something to worry about, but because doctors are confusing dietary cholesterol with blood cholesterol, they still tell people to limit eggs, shellfish, and other high cholesterol foods, even though there's no evidence that this does anything beneficial. What about blood cholesterol? As unusual as it may sound, blood cholesterol is not a bad thing either. Because cholesterol is a potent antioxidant, we need it flowing through our arteries to help protect them against oxidative damage. Of course, we're all told that having high blood cholesterol is bad. So, let's take a closer look. Does cholesterol cause heart attacks? If having higher cholesterol really did cause heart attacks, then people hospitalized for a heart attack would have had high cholesterol levels before their attack. Their levels should be, on average, above the normal range. Likewise, if low cholesterol were protective, people hospitalized for a heart attack would not have had low cholesterol beforehand. But when a very large study asked the simple question, "What is the cholesterol level that people admitted to the hospital with a heart attack have?" that was not what they saw. In 2009, a multi-center study of 136,905 people hospitalized with heart attacks found that only 25% had LDL bad cholesterol levels that would be considered high at the time they entered the hospital, 130 milligrams per deciliter or higher. Slightly more people, 35%, reported having been previously told they'd had some kind of high cholesterol at least once in their lives. In other words, normal and low cholesterol was a far better predictor of heart attack than high cholesterol. The truth is in the fine print. You can catch a glimpse of the lack of foundational support for the cholesterol theory in a surprising place: the Mazola corn oil bottle. The fine print under its heart healthy label directs you to a side panel with some interesting legalese. You can also find this on the Mazola website. It says, "Very limited and preliminary scientific evidence suggests that eating about 1 tablespoon or 16 grams of corn oil daily may reduce the risk of heart disease due to the unsaturated fat content in corn oil." That sentence is followed by another one that states, contradictorily, that the FDA, or Federal Drug Administration, concludes that there is little scientific evidence supporting this claim. You might think this would get cardiologists scratching their heads about the utility of treating high cholesterol. But instead of questioning cholesterol's validity as a risk factor, The medical community responded to this information by doubling down on cholesterol phobia. Here's what they actually said. These findings may provide further support for recent guideline revisions with even lower LDL goals. In other words, the problem is not that the whole idea is wrong. It's that cholesterol is even more dangerous than we thought. This viewpoint fails to explain the study's observations. Our guidelines keep moving the goalposts on what's considered a safe level of cholesterol. The authors of the article quoted above were referring to guideline revisions that had taken place in 2004, when doctors were given a new, lower set of cholesterol values to work with. Prior to 2004, a total cholesterol level of 240 milligrams per deciliter was considered normal. After 2004, the number was cut to 199 milligrams per deciliter. The LDL cutoff was lowered too, from 130 down to 100 milligrams per deciliter. This was hardly the first time the definition of high cholesterol had changed. In 1970, the cutoff for normal total cholesterol was 310 milligrams per deciliter. During my career, I've seen that cutoff lowered from 260 to 240 and now 199 milligrams per deciliter. Likewise, normal LDL has been ratcheted down from 180 to 100 milligrams per deciliter. For a person with multiple risk factors, LDL now needs to be under 70 milligrams per deciliter. And some lipidologists, the cholesterol specialists, are still calling for that number to be reduced to well below 40. What is going on here? Why do our guidelines keep pushing LDL levels down? Our guidelines keep changing because the experts writing them don't know what they don't know. These specialists are not listening to the specialists who study the link between oxidative stress and heart attacks. The two groups do not communicate, and as we'll see, the disconnect is not an accident. It's being actively maintained. The lipid scientists have been saying that vegetable oil causes oxidative stress, and that lower cholesterol levels may be an indication of greater vegetable oil-induced oxidative stress. This explains why in a population eating more vegetable oils than ever, lower cholesterol correlates with heart attacks. But because doctors are working with only partial information, they can't interpret data correctly. Unfortunately, patients are stuck seeing doctors who truly don't know what causes heart attacks, but think that they do. I've yet to see any guideline acknowledge an important statistic. The cholesterol levels of our entire population have been going down over time. In 1960, the average adult cholesterol level was 222 milligrams per deciliter. In 2000, the average cholesterol level was 203 milligrams per deciliter. Today, it is 189 milligrams per deciliter. If high cholesterol were truly associated with worsening health, one might expect our average cholesterol figures to have gone up in tandem with our increasing rates of obesity and diabetes. But that's not what's happened. The perils of low cholesterol. The end goal of any public health recommendation is not lowering cholesterol. It's helping you live longer. Dying with lower cholesterol levels is not the goal. Not one human clinical trial has shown that lowering cholesterol produces a beneficial effect. At least not any trial that reported its data truthfully, as I want to show you here. Vegetable oils do indeed lower cholesterol. This has been proven time and again. It's not controversial at all. And this effect is so predictable, in the 1960s, a physiologist named Ansel Keys actually worked out an equation that accurately predicted how much a person's cholesterol levels would drop given a specific dose of PUFA. But the promised benefits of this dietary change rested entirely on the assumption that lowering cholesterol prevented heart attacks, something that Dr. Keys called the diet-heart hypothesis. During the past 70 years, only one large, randomized, controlled, double-blinded clinical trial in humans has ever directly tested the assumption, and that didn't quite go as planned. What's a randomized, controlled, double-blinded study? The purpose of this sort of clinical nutrition trial is to compare the effectiveness of a new diet against the standard diet, called the control, in preventing a given health outcome, such as heart attack or death. In this sort of study, you gather together two large groups of people who you think are similar on every variable you can imagine: age, weight, lifestyle, social class. You let one group eat their normal, control diet, and give the other group something you think is healthier. And then follow them for years and see what happens. It's best if the diets are identical in every way except for a single variable, so you can pin any observed effects on that variable. Being randomized and double-blinded means that neither the participants nor the researchers themselves know who is receiving the experimental treatment and who is not. This helps to reduce the likelihood of any bias on the researcher's part affecting the results. It also reduces the chance of the participants' expectations or the placebo effect skewing the outcome. In the 1960s and early 1970s, Dr. Keyes worked with several cardiologists to design a study called the Minnesota Coronary Experiment, funded by the American Heart Association. This study was huge, having enrolled nearly 15,000 people. To this day, it stands as one of the most rigorous diet trials ever conducted. It was so large and so meticulously controlled that it is unlikely to ever be bested. When the study results started rolling in, the data surprised everyone. It turned out that lowering cholesterol with vegetable oils did not have the expected benefits. In fact, a preliminary analysis provided reason to believe it had some serious harms, including raising cancer risk. So, what did the research team do? Dr. Keyes and his collaborators gathered up the data, slides, and other evidence, packed it into a bunch of file boxes, and kept the boxes in a basement. Decades later, a savvy scientist working for the National Institutes of Health, or NIH, Chris Ramsden, MD, noticed that a grant had been approved for a one-of-a-kind experiment to test the diet-heart hypothesis back in the 1960s. But he couldn't find where the final data had ever been properly published. After some clever detective work, his team managed to locate the basement where the files lay hidden, stashed away by one of the study authors who'd recently passed away. His family hadn't yet gotten around to selling his home in Minnesota. Some of the data was missing, but there was more than enough to draw some very important conclusions. The belated analysis of the remaining original half-century-old data showed something shocking. It looked like swapping out saturated fat for polyunsaturated fat increased mortality, even as it also reduced cholesterol. In fact, for every 30 points that eating seed oils lowered a person's total cholesterol, that person's chance of dying increased by 22%. In other words, the people whose cholesterol dropped the most had the worst possible health outcome: death. Keep in mind, the study was intended specifically to demonstrate the validity of the cholesterol theory of heart disease. Its double-blind, randomized design represents the gold standard of clinical trials. In other words, as much as anything in medicine can ever be proven, this study proves the cholesterol theory wrong. Dead wrong, quite literally. Dr. Ramsden's group published these findings in the British Medical Journal in 2016. Their report specifically emphasized that lowering cholesterol could be dangerous, but the medical world barely responded to this paradigm-shifting news. Part of the lackluster response may be related to the fact that busy medical professionals can't possibly keep up with all the articles being pushed across our desks every day. Just as TV viewers don't always want to hear all the details of the news from investigative journalists, preferring to get the bare-bones bottom line from their favorite trusted anchors, doctors rely on celebrated medical authorities. When it comes to nutrition science, we want to hear from physicians who do nutrition research, and we want to know what we're supposed to do about the newsworthy item. Is this a better approach? Will we need to change our practices? Or can we spare ourselves the trouble of even thinking about it? After Dr. Ramsden's publication of the 40-year-old missing evidence, the medical media turned to one of their favorite sources, Walter Willett, M.D., to summarize Dr. Ramsden's research in a clear, concise way. As a tenured professor of epidemiology and nutrition at Harvard School of Public Health, he would appear to be more than qualified to translate the findings and put them into their proper perspective. Here's what he said about the importance of this long-overdue data analysis.
This is an interesting historical footnote that has no relevance to current dietary recommendations that emphasize replacing saturated fat with polyunsaturated fat.
I'd like to frame up Dr. Willett's frame-up so that busy readers like yourself can decide if you want to take Harvard's nutrition advice to heart in the future. Thousands of doctors around the world look at their patients' cholesterol numbers every day and advise dietary changes that emphasize replacing saturated fats with polyunsaturated fats based on a theory that would have been seriously undermined or quite possibly entirely dismissed had this evidence seen the light of day when it should have. Consider also that Dr. Ramsden's study, far from being a historical footnote that has no relevance, is not the only one to find that lowering cholesterol might have negative consequences that doctors and their patients ought to be made aware of. An alarming number of studies now reveal that people with lower cholesterol are more likely to develop scary diseases or die. You have to dig to find them, but here are a few examples of what's out there. Let's start with cancer. A 2012 article showed the results of three large trials where people were given either cholesterol-lowering drugs called statins or placebos. These trials all showed that people on the statin drugs developed 20 to 25% more cancers than people on the placebo. The authors also reported that many articles had found an association between low cholesterol and cancers of the colon, lung, and prostate, as well as dying from any kind of cancer. A 2007 BMJ article found a disturbing, highly significant risk of newly diagnosed cancer in people with the lowest LDL levels. A 2011 study in Japan suggested that the problem extends to cardiovascular disease, exactly the disease that lowering cholesterol is supposed to prevent. The title of the article makes it clear. Low cholesterol is associated with mortality from stroke, heart disease, and cancer. Mortality means death, in case that wasn't obvious. Dr. Ramsden had actually published another study that reevaluated lost evidence from another trial, also performed in the 1960s and 1970s, that was never properly reported. That study was a clinical trial too, a very large and well-designed one, although not double-blinded like the other study was. It compared a high PUFA diet to a typical diet of the day, which used animal fat and margarines containing saturated fat, and some trans fat from the margarine. This study showed that people who ate animal fat and margarines had 13% higher total cholesterol than the people on the high PUFA diet, 266.5 versus 243.9 milligrams per deciliter. They also had a whopping 60% fewer heart attacks, 16.3% versus 10.1%, and fewer overall deaths, 17.6% versus 11.8%. A potpourri of studies link low cholesterol to a variety of other conditions. In 2016, A study in China showed that every 40-point uptick in total or LDL cholesterol imparted incrementally stronger protection against dementia. Low cholesterol has also been linked to a life-threatening form of infection called sepsis, where the body is overwhelmed by bacteria in the bloodstream and organs start to shut down. And it's been linked to death or near death from COVID-19. Cholesterol has been called a gatekeeper of male fertility. And it's not just men. Many women with premature ovarian failure have very low cholesterol. Inflammatory conditions and autoimmune diseases, including psoriasis, rheumatoid arthritis, and lupus, have also been linked to low cholesterol. And by the way, we treat those diseases with steroid drugs, which are related to cortisol, a hormone our bodies make from cholesterol. In fact, it's entirely possible that if you have any condition that's been treated with steroids, you might be able to improve that condition by raising your cholesterol. A 2012 publication from Denmark found that people with total cholesterol levels above 200 milligrams per deciliter were less likely to die during the study's 8-year duration than people with lower numbers. A 2012 Brazilian study on adults aged 60 to 85 showed that people with total cholesterol of 170 or less were 50% more likely to die than people with total cholesterol of 200 or more during the 12-year study period. Here in the United States, a 2021 publication in Nature showed that pushing your LDL down below 80, whether by diet or drugs, doubles your risk of dying in the next 8 years compared to people with higher numbers. This particular article concluded, further studies are warranted to determine the causal relationship between LDL-C, LDL cholesterol level, and all-cause mortality. In other words, it's time to start looking at why low cholesterol might be killing people. This is just a sampling of the reports clearly linking low cholesterol to death and disease of various kinds. Individually, any one of these studies would call to question our decades-old dietary advice. As a group, these articles should be paradigm-shifting, and they should impact most of medical practice. Yet that's not what has happened. In fact, sometimes the authors of studies on PUFAs and the dangers of low cholesterol are subject to undue attack. The wrong kind of science. Dr. Glenn D. Lawrence is a professor in the Department of Chemistry and Biochemistry at Long Island University in Brooklyn. His laboratory specializes in polyunsaturated fatty acid metabolism. In 2021, he published an article warning that one way PUFAs lower cholesterol is by disrupting the proper distribution of fats and cholesterol, and in so doing, building inflammatory atherosclerotic deposits surrounding the arteries. In other words, vegetable oils lower our blood cholesterol levels by depositing oxidized material in and around your arterial walls, where it can cause heart attacks. Dr. Lawrence also pointed out that this idea is not new. Many other scientists in a variety of fields have suggested the exact same thing, dating back to the early 1950s. Dr. Lawrence's description of how cholesterol-lowering PUFAs damage arteries is based on solid science. Yet academics from the University of California, Los Angeles, and other institutions wrote letters to the editor complaining about it. They accused Dr. Lawrence of fear-mongering and being out of touch with reputable researchers. Instead of arguing against his points, the authors primarily argued that he was looking at the wrong kind of evidence. Dr. Lawrence cited mostly animal and in vitro, meaning test tube, lab-based studies, that his detractors felt should be ignored because they were lower down on the hierarchy of evidence as shown by a pyramid-shaped diagram. The two bottom layers of the pyramid were the in vitro and animal studies. At the top of the pyramid sits a kind of study called a meta-analysis of randomized controlled clinical trials, labeled as the gold standard. What animal studies can tell us. Human clinical trials are limited to what's ethical, thankfully. We can't, for example, test out the most effective diet that would give people heart attacks. For that, we use animal studies, for better or for worse. When researchers try to uncover the answer, they've found it exceedingly difficult to give animals heart attacks at all. In fact, I was unable to find a single animal study where the outcome was heart attack. Instead, the studies report on diets that can give animals atherosclerosis. And even this has proven rather difficult to do using animal fats. Rabbits need to be repeatedly injected with snake venom, or have their arteries burned with electrocautery, or stretched by inserting balloons and inflating them. Mice and rats need to be genetically modified and subjected to photochemical injury. Scientists agree that pig models are probably the best way to recreate human plaque, but you have to inject them with a poison called streptozocin first, which gives them type 1 diabetes. Even with all these genetic modifications and other health disturbances, in order to give rats atherosclerosis using animal fats, scientists had to formulate a chow with 5 times more fat than normal rodent chow, and thousands of times more cholesterol by weight. The resulting atherogenic rodent diet contains so many additional unfortified calories that unless the animals eat themselves overweight, they won't get adequate protein. The daily cholesterol ration in this formula equates to a human equivalent of 22,500 milligrams, the amount in 92 sticks of butter. Obviously, this is not a realistic human diet. The most efficient way for scientists to give animals atherosclerosis is by feeding them either oxidized vegetable oils or oxidized cholesterol. Importantly, the cholesterol in foods such as burgers and chicken does not oxidize to any measurable degree with normal cooking practices. However, if beef tallow is continually heated for days, as in deep frying, the cholesterol would likely oxidize over time. This suggests that oxidized fats and oils are key dietary ingredients to avoid if you want to limit plaque buildup and avoid heart attacks. But labeling the meta-analysis as the gold standard is terrifically misleading. These sorts of studies are generally used when individual studies are inconclusive or conflicting in order to discern which way most of the evidence points. Unfortunately, they are often regarded as gospel and beyond reproach, so that a single meta-analysis may dramatically change our treatment protocols. Trusting a meta-analysis more than every other form of evidence is dangerous because it represents the ultimate form of condensed information, a summary of summaries, if you will. That leaves a lot of wiggle room to make the results come out the way we want them to. This is called confirmation bias. The meta-analysis can be manipulated to produce a variety of different results, depending on what studies are included and what studies are excluded. For example, if some studies show that it's more likely to rain in July than in December, and other studies show the opposite, a meta-analysis that included only studies from India, where the monsoon season occurs in summer, may show rain is more likely to occur in July. However, a meta-analysis that included only studies from California, where the monsoon season occurs in winter, would show the opposite. Neither would help someone living in, say, New York, predict the weather. I think if individual studies are conflicting, we need to consider that there may be some problems with the foundational idea. A key concept may be missing. In the aforementioned example, the missing concept relates to geography and its effect on local climate. In the medical world, the missing concept is often related to vegetable oil and its susceptibility to oxidation. When I spoke to one scientist, who asked me not to use her name, about data manipulation, she told me, "I basically watched one investigator do everything he could, short of inventing and revising the data himself, to find a good outcome." Not because he was paid to do so, mind you. simply because he was so sure his interventions were going to work that he lost his scientist's impartiality. This is called an intellectual conflict of interest, and it's quite dangerous since most people are not aware of their own biases. Since we've all grown up with the ideology that cholesterol is bad, most investigators have this bias. All too often, authors of meta-analyses simply exclude studies that don't support their idea. It's at their discretion, as long as they explain why they made the choices they made. What's more, the authors can also make claims about a study's conclusions that aren't entirely accurate. But the only way to know would be to check the references, and doctors may not have access to the full text, thanks to most journals being behind paywalls. And certainly, most doctors lack the time or inclination to fact-check sources in addition to their day-to-day workload. Another problem with dismissing the foundational types of science that are listed at the bottom of this hierarchy of evidence is that most of medical knowledge is built on exactly this sort of evidence. If we were to dismiss the base of this pyramid, then we would have to dismiss all of the basic physiology that informs us about how the human body works. Without basic in vitro science, we wouldn't have discovered cholesterol in the first place. We wouldn't have the germ theory of disease. We'd still be in the dark ages of our understanding of the human body and biology itself. The pyramid-shaped hierarchy of evidence inaccurately suggests that one type of study is superior to all the rest. The reality is, there is a logical progression to building and testing scientific ideas. Each type of evidence has a use. Each has its own set of advantages and disadvantages, and all types should be considered. In fact, if the statistical correlations between a nutrient and a disease aren't held up by the foundational mechanistic studies, they probably represent correlations only, and should at least be examined for possible flaws and biases, if not dismissed. In other words, basic science belongs at the foundation of the pyramid for support. Not because it's lower in quality. If your pyramid of evidence lacks a base, then your idea has not been properly developed. In fact, the pyramid of evidence for the idea that high cholesterol is harmful rests on a dubious base. That's thanks to the work of the physiologist I mentioned in this chapter and we'll discuss again in the next, Dr. Ansel Keys. His work, more than anyone else's, is cited as the foundational evidence upon which the cholesterol theory of heart disease rests. His story takes us back to the post-World War II era, at a time when the food supply was dramatically shifting and when medical science started losing interest in nutrition in favor of pharmaceutical interventions.